Thank y'all. Please be seated. We have one case on our 230 docket. The panel consists of myself, Justice Wade Birdwell, the justice to my left, Justice Brian Walker, and the justice to my right, Justice Dabney Basil. And we will be considering oral argument in this case once the clerk calls the case. So let's begin.
The court will now call Vivian Casper versus Texas Women's University. And may it please the court, Mr. Christian Jennings, for the appellant, Ms. Allison Collins, for the appellant.
All righty.
All right, may it please the court. Good afternoon, justices, staff counsel, Ms. Collins, Ms. Green. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Christian Denny. I represent Dr. Vivian Casper, who's behind me to my left, who is a longtime professor at Texas Women's University. She's been so employed since 1969 and tenured in 1978. During her tenure, she's taught more than 30 different English courses to thousands of students and received numerous accolades, including Faculty of the Year and Favorite Faculty Member at Texas Women's University. Her life, her passion is educating students.
Counselor, I'll just interject. We're all very familiar with the facts of the case and the professor's lengthy resume and awards and all that good stuff. And obviously, no matter how much we might sympathize with her, we have to decide this under the law. And so if you don't mind, unless my colleagues want to hear more about it, I would like to jump to the first issue and hear what
well,
you have
let
to
me,
say.
Well, let me ask you one preliminary question. What relief do you want in this case?
From this court or in total?
In total.
Well, in total, we want injunctive and declaratory relief, one of which would be to there are no monetary damages claims. This is all injunctive and declaratory relief.
Well, what do you enjoin? What do you want the injunction to require?
The injunction would require a couple of things, but first, on the due process, due course arguments, is to provide what has been called a constitutionally sufficient name-clearing hearing by the Fifth Circuit. That's one on the procedural due process claim, and then on the First Amendment claim, not to infringe and to trample on her rights under the First Amendment. We have elaborated on that in more detail in our filings to the trial court, but summing it up, that's what we're seeking here. If you want me to go directly to the law on this action, happy to do so, but I want to put one thing in as far as the clarity here and how this plays into some of the cases we're going to discuss here today. Dr. Casper has been suspended for over 2 years. So all of these cases that are addressing short-term suspensions and name-clearing hearings during a short-term suspension, they don't apply because Dr. Casper remains suspended. She has no role. She does not teach. She has no responsibilities. And all of that is being held up by this argument that the state institution and their individual defendants can do whatever they want as long as she's paid, which is not the law.
How do we get around Klingler and Dupree and Richards versus City of Weatherford basically saying as long as she's getting paid, she keeps her tenure, and that it's perfectly okay that she can't come to the campus and she can't teach what she used to teach?
Okay. So understand that's a good point, and that's part of what I was referencing before. So they've relied essentially on three cases. Klingler's one you mentioned, but in Klingler, if you recall, they actually did have a due process hearing, which is different in this case. The others they rely on, and I'm going to mispronounce it, but Kelher versus Flan, which is a 1985 Fifth Circuit case about change in assignments. I do pray the case you mentioned, Justice Birdwell, about denying preferred teaching opportunities, Decker versus Houston about changing schedule. That's just not this case. Those are minor issues.
Why is it, so all of those cases, going back to Paul versus Davis, okay, is your what you're dealing with is this concept of defamation plus, effectively, okay?
Stigma plus. Is that
what the
liberty interest?
Yeah, the liberty interest type of thing. Because what I'm concerned about in this case is effectively your client's been put in academic purgatory where she's paid, she's tenured, and she has all of her benefits still, but she can't actually practice. She's effectively unemployed, okay? And so my question is there any authority that says, because when you read Richards, when you read Klingler, and they say you don't have a right to be on campus and you don't have a right to participate in activities, that type of thing, okay? All of that is said in the context, I believe, in Klingler, the professor was actually sent home to do research from home. So it was in fact, in a reassignment type of situation. So there was still something that he was employed to do, and he was being paid what he had been paid and kept his tenure, et cetera. And under those circumstances, the Fifth Circuit held you have no cause of action. That doesn't get you there, okay? But here, she hasn't been reassigned. Am I correct?
Well, she hasn't. There, she has nothing.
She hasn't been sent home to do research. She been given any type of reassignment whatsoever?
No, there's no role, Your Honor.
Okay, and the record doesn't reflect. It just reflects that she's getting paid. She keeps her tenure, but that's about it.
So I do have 2 points in response to what I understood your question is. So if you look at the case cited by the state, I'm going to mispronounce it again, Kellyer versus Flawn, on page 1087 of that citation, they actually reference that a significant loss in responsibility can equal a liberty interest in the professorial context. So that's one. And two, Jett versus DISD, which is a 1986 Fifth Circuit case, also says that specific assignments can possibly invoke due process and due course considerations. And my point to the court on that is those detailed issues are fact issues that need to be fleshed out in discovery. Because in this case, which is different than Klingler and the others, they are hiding and hoarding the evidence. In those other cases, they brought forth and said, this is what you did. In this case, they have not, and they refuse to tell you what it is.
Now, the Attorney General's brief, they claim that she was given the opportunity to train, and it almost sounds like to retrain for something else, but she filed the suit instead, I think is what their brief says. Do you agree with that? Do you disagree with that?
I don't agree that this suit was filed instead of any type of training. I mean, every professor, I'm a professor, I have training that I have to do. Every professor has training. I don't agree with that analysis or that conclusion. And the other thing I point to on that is they're also going outside of the record. That is one of the key points in this case. They said in their brief that we are arguing revisionist history, that they're arguing facts contrary to what were in the pleadings. They cannot do that. The standard is light most favorable to the plaintiff. And we've set forth ultra-virus claims against individual defendants that regardless of whether you provide or you apply the ex parte Young doctrine or the ultra-virus doctrine.
What non-discretionary act did the individuals named in their individual capacities not perform?
They have not performed any act associated with constitutional due process. There has been.
Defined by what?
Every case. They have not provided what's required by the Texas Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, which requires at a minimum they provide notice and the evidence to give her an opportunity to rebut that evidence. She even filed a grievance of her, under institutional policy. They ignored it and chose not to address it whatsoever. So there's no way for Dr. Casper to get her due process, to get her due course of law. She's pled and asserted both a property interest and a liberty interest under the stigma plus test, which requires the stigmatization, which clearly being labeled as a demeaning and discriminatory individual is stigmatizing. And then the plus is the property interest to continue in her chosen profession. There's case law after case law about that, and they argue that the Loudermill case from the U.S. Supreme Court allows them to do whatever they want as long as they pay. But if you look at Gilbert versus Homer from 1997, the U.S. Supreme Court says that is not a sweeping or categorical rule. The difference in those cases, in Loudermill, the United States Supreme Court said for 7 months a suspension's okay until that hearing occurs. It just didn't happen here. We're on 2 years. The Sixth Circuit in 2021 decided Kaplan versus the University of Louisville, and in that case, it said Gilbert dispelled the notion that Loudermill established a per se harbor, safe harbor, by just paying someone. That's not the law. They're trying to pin it in, but it's not there. There have been cases since Loudermill, and in Loudermill itself said this is not a strong one-all and be-all standard. I'm happy to address more of the constitutional argument on the due process side, but if I may,
let me ask you this. Since your argument is that the only relief you're seeking is prospective, okay? So I take it you're seeking a hearing?
Ultimately, Your Honor, there would have to be a due process hearing.
And you want some discovery to prepare for that hearing?
We absolutely want the discovery, because the class at issue was conducted via Zoom. Every class was recorded. The institution has refused to indicate what was demeaning and what was discriminatory. They've actually also said that evidence goes back 11 years.
Well, now, they've represented that she did, in fact, get a copy of the complaint from the student. Is that correct?
There was a complaint provided, but the difference, Your Honor, is the case law says the evidence has to be provided. And in this case, there was one generic letter sent, then a second letter, and that second letter says there's evidence dating back 11 years that supports our position, which so happens to be.
So you're complaining about the sandbag.
Yeah, so that's also so happens to be how long her direct superior, Dr. West, was in the position above her. So for 11 years, they're saying there's all this evidence, even though there's never been another formal complaint. She has to have the opportunity to rebut that.
Is there anything in the record since the classes that apparently this demeaning engagement occurred in were on Zoom? Were those being recorded?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did she record them herself, or did she get access to the recordings to demonstrate what was actually said during these classes, as opposed to just taking the student's word for it?
Your Honor, and this is in the pleadings that have been filed, no, yes, they were recorded, and no, they have not been provided despite request. Both open records, not just both, open records, in informal request and discovery in this case. We've been denied access to that all the way along, and that's what I was indicating earlier when they're saying there's this argument of revisionist history. They're trying to argue the facts while also hiding in the cloak of darkness. They won't tell us what she said. Just won't tell us.
And they and as far as you don't know if they interviewed any of the other students that were present that day. You don't know.
We have no idea. There's an indication that people were interviewed. We don't know what that was. We don't know when. We don't know what they said. We've seen no witness statements. There was never that opportunity to rebut that evidence. And that's the primary focus of the due process, due course argument for a professor, a tenured professor in the state of Texas. She had no such opportunity. And here we are. We're still, to this day, have no idea what they're saying she did. They said, well, she demeaned students. Well, what?
And again, no matter how sympathetic I might be or we may be or anybody may be to her and what they have not done for her. If these specific individuals who you've made these claims against are also cloaked with the same immunity that the institution is cloaked with, then you concede that stops it right there. We our hands are tied.
How do they get that immunity? Because an ultravirus claim, ex parte Young doctrine claim, waives the immunity for that purpose. They've argued in their briefing that the 11th Amendment applies. That doesn't apply. The United States Supreme Court has said that. The Texas Supreme Court has said 11th Amendment immunity does not apply to individual defendants. So we've pled and asserted claims under both doctrines, which gets us over the hurdle at the pleading stage. If they have an argument as to whether, you know, certain claims from a merit standpoint should go forward, that's an argument for a later day. This is, did we put down on paper a claim in a light most favorable to Dr. Casper?
But they're saying that the reason that the difference here is it's the whether or not federal law is being applied in state court as opposed to the opposite. And I believe the state's position is this is a situation where we're in state court and you have federal law and you have cases that say that the federal law, that these don't apply in that instance. Do you not agree with that?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor, because what we would point the court to is on the 11th Amendment issue, if that's the issue you're addressing, Will versus Michigan Department of State Police, 11th Amendment doesn't apply in state court. If you want to look at it from a state perspective, San Antonio ISD versus McKinney, Texas Supreme Court, 1996, 11th Amendment does not protect the ISD members from suit. That's the ultravirus doctrine. We have pled that. We've asserted claims against each one of the individuals. We've put it on paper. Now let us go argue on the merits. Let us get our discovery. We'll prove our case. I'm out of time. Happy to take any questions.
Counsel, I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Justices.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court, Allison Collins on behalf of Texas Women's University, and joining me is General Counsel for Texas Women's University. I'm going to start by addressing this notion of revisionist history. Throughout plaintiff's briefing and here at argument, they have claimed that she was placed on leave because of her speech or because she was quote-unquote suspended because the university substantiated a student's complaint against her. But if you look at the amended petition, this is not the case. She was placed on leave when the university received the complaint. She was placed on leave before any investigation took place, before anyone delved into the facts of what was or was not said in a classroom, and before making any finding as to the veracity or the substantiation of that complaint.
So the university can keep her on leave indefinitely?
Well,
indefinitely, as long as they pay her. That appears to be the university's position.
It is not the university's position, and I do want to point two things out to the court on that point. One, CR 184, which is the notice of paid administrative leave, says that she's to continue in her individual activities, meaning her scholarship. She still had a role with the university. She just wasn't teaching courses. The other point, which is something that we'd ask this court to take judicial notice of, is the plaintiff has since filed two lawsuits.
Hold on
yes.
Real quick, and this point. I'm pretty sure that the appellant would say that that's not in the record. Where is it in the record that she was able to continue in her individual?
CR 184, the notice of the notice placing her on paid administrative leave told her that she was expected to continue with her individual activities, and additionally that she was to keep normal business hours.
Okay. It doesn't say professional activities. It says individual activities.
Which would be her scholarship.
Okay. Where does it say that in the notice?
That is what was intended.
And where is that? Well, how do we know that? It may be in the record. How are we to interpret it that way?
Yes. And again, that's going to go back to, you know, if plaintiff is going to allege that she has not been permitted to continue with her scholarship, you know, you will have to take that allegation as true. We obviously disagree based off of the notice that she was instructed to continue in her other activities. Now, the other point that I would ask this court to take judicial notice of is that she has since filed two complaints claiming that she has been removed from university committees, which she served on after this investigation of the student complaint ended. Those cases, one is in federal court. It's at 423 CV00042. That's the Eastern District. She's also filed in Denton District Court 23042546 7. That again shows that contrary to what she's representing to this court, she had other faculty responsibilities over the last 2 years.
Counsel, that's not in our record.
No, but it's,
if you're wanting us to take judicial notice of it,
yes,
then you need to provide whatever it is you want us to take notice of and not simply give us something that we can go track down on PACER.
Okay. Of course, I can do so.
Has she ever been given a hearing to rebut the charges that have been brought against her or to present her own evidence with respect to the charges that have been brought against her?
So she did have a meeting after she received the notice of paid administrative leave. Approximately 2 weeks later, she was asked to meet with the university's investigator. She was provided a copy of the student complaint. She was asked to tell her side of the story. She was given the opportunity to provide her own evidence speaking to that as part of the investigation.
And it's your argument that satisfies due process?
As to the notice of leave, yes. And again, the notice of leave came before any finding related to a student complaint or any finding that she had failed to accommodate a student's disabilities or had engaged in demeaning conduct. And yes, I do believe, again, this goes back to the most comparable cases, say that this is a informal give and take. They tell you what evidence they have. They did that. It was the student complaint. That's what the university had at that point in time when they placed her on paid admin leave. You let them say they're tied to the story, and that's what the university did.
Why shouldn't we just kick this back and let a little bit of discovery occur with regard to the recording of the classrooms, or at least to find out what actually y'all did to verify the complaint?
As to the due process claim specifically,
sure.
Because as this court has already recognized.
How are we to determine whether due process has been met if there's no ability to check and see whether due process has actually been met?
Because due process, in terms of a hearing or notice, is only required if a constitutionally protected property or liberty interest is implicated by the case.
Okay, let's go back to, I was corrected, stigma, not defamation plus. Thank you. Moore versus Otero, 557, Fed Second, 435, 1977, Fifth Circuit, footnote 11. It says the plus is that it must, quote, be regarded essentially as a loss of employment under the circumstances. The court found in those circumstances that the reduction from a corporal in law enforcement to a patrolman, I think it was a Louisiana police officer, because he still had duties under the circumstances, that was not the plus that was necessary. My question is if you have effectively, using my phrase, academic purgatory, if you've placed somebody into academic purgatory where they can't come on campus, they can't teach, they can't do anything other than, for the very first time I'm hearing today, that her individual activities can continue, and we're taking your word for it that meant she could do whatever her scholarship was one way or the other, but I'm not remembering that actually being anywhere in the record, okay? That seems to be what the circuit is talking about in footnote 11, which is you are so completely wiped out in terms of your ability to practice your trade or to ply your trade that you effectively, even though you're getting paid, it's effectively a sinecure, if you will, and you're not actually getting to do your profession, to do your trade, and that seems to be the suggestion. It hasn't ever been fleshed out, but Moore versus Otero is what undergirds both Klingler and Richards.
And both Richards and Dupree recognized that they rejected the exact argument the plaintiff is attempting to make here, that, okay, my property interest is not implicated, so
except
I have a liberty interest.
There's no discussion of what I'm raising, which is, can there be such an obliteration of the actual employment, okay? Not just a demotion, not just a reassignment. All of those cases are talking about, we're going to move you over here. Klingler is, we're going to send you home to do your research, okay? But you're still going to be working for us. You still have duties to do with regard to that. But where in this record, other than what you've cited to us today about individual activities, is there anything that indicates that she's doing anything just sitting at home twiddling her thumbs and getting paid to do it?
In Richards, the court held that they rejected a liberty interest in Richards for the municipal judge, even though he was sitting at home twiddling his thumbs. He had no roles and no duties. And it stated that it is well established that retention of employment negates a person's claim that they were denied a liberty. Indeed, when an employee retains his position, even after being defamed by a public officer, the only claim of stigma he has derives from the injury to his reputation, an interest that Paul reveals does not rise to the level of a liberty interest. They then goes on at pages 792 and 793 within the Richards opinion to string cite numerous cases in the Fifth Circuit and beyond, holding that no liberty interest is implicated when the individual retains their employment.
And that's Fifth Circuit, correct?
That is. That's the Richards v. Weatherford case.
Right, and that was back in 2001.
Yes, that is correct. And those cases were not abrogated or otherwise they don't conflict with the Supreme Court's holding in Gilbert. If you look at what Gilbert said directly before the quotation the plaintiff provides, Gilbert extended Laudermill. Gilbert said, well, there are circumstances even when you suspend someone without pay that due process is not implicated. In fact, the court said again, Gilbert, directly above what plaintiff cited, to say that when the government employer perceives a hazard in leaving the employee on the job, it can avoid the problem by suspending with pay is not to say that that is the only way of avoiding the problem. It then went on to discuss that there are instances where you can suspend someone without pay and there not be a due process problem. I do want to touch briefly on immunity, the ultra-virus doctrine. I agree with Justice Walker. Our position is that we're in state court. The ultra-virus doctrine applies. There is no place for the 11th Amendment or the ex parte doctrine within the state's jurisprudence. In addition to failing to state facially valid ultra-virus claims, plaintiffs' claims fail for at least two additional reasons. And that's because, whether, again, ex parte Young or the ultra-virus doctrine, you have to show that the individuals she has sued have a connection to the challenged act, i.e. that they have trampled on her rights, and that she is seeking proper prospective relief. She has done neither in this case. Counsel has said what his ultimate relief is, but if you look at what's in his amended petition, he seeks various forms of retrospective relief, saying, I want a declaration that they violated her rights with that investigation. He also seeks to control state action by requiring university officials to take affirmative actions such as assigning her classes to teach, which federal courts have held you cannot do under Ex parte Young, and which the Texas Supreme Court has held are also barred by sovereign immunity. Additionally, if you're looking at the claims against individual university officials, and that's what we have left here, she simply has not provided a factual basis for these claims against each and every individual. For some of these individuals, there's no allegations of how they were involved or if they were involved with the notice placing her on leave or the outcome of the investigation. Rather, some of the individuals are listed because they were interviewed as part of the investigation. Or when you're looking at both due process and the First Amendment claim, we're talking about individuals that Dr. Casper asked to meet with, met with to discuss her investigation and her current situation, and she didn't get the relief she wanted. And somehow that serves as the basis for her First Amendment claims and her due process claims against those individuals. And that's particularly Defendant Faton and Defendant Kapanis. I do want to briefly touch upon plaintiff's First Amendment claim, and specifically the notion set forth in the reply brief that that she was restricted as to private speech on a matter of public concern. Now, the restriction in the record is that notice of paid administrative leave. It restricted her official capacity speech, which there's no dispute the university can legally do.
Why would that not have been overbroad? Because it could be read to include that she could not talk to the other three students in her class to obtain potential defensive information or evidence with regard to the complaint against her?
Sure. So first, it noted that if she thought she needed to talk to someone for reasons like that, she should contact one of the officials.
Okay. Call us for permission.
Yes.
Right.
The other,
but otherwise, she's told you can't talk to anybody about it.
The other issue concerning this First Amendment claim is that plaintiff has not asserted private speech on a matter of public concern. And Garcetti held that if speech is not on a matter of public concern, the employee has no First Amendment cause of action. And plaintiff has the burden to demonstrate that she was engaging in private speech on a matter of public concern. She has not done so. Rather, any restriction the notice placed on Casper's private speech related to her paid leave and the investigation of the student complaint. These are matters of personal interest and a private grievance against her employer related to her employment. And the Fifth Circuit has specifically held that there is no constitutionally protected speech involved when an employee is speaking on a matter of personal interest, such as the terms and conditions of her own employment. That's in Dorsett 940 F. 2nd 121 in 1991. And that's what we have here. Plaintiff has only cited to Garcetti and Pickering as supporting that she was engaging in private speech on a matter of public concern, and both of those cases are readily distinguishable here. Neither is on point. As this court is probably familiar, Garcetti was a district attorney who sent an internal memo saying we're going forward on charges where there are false representations within this affidavit, and we should not do so. He was penalized for that, and even there, the court held that while exposing government inefficiency and misconduct is a matter of considerable significance, it is not enough. Pickering, conversely, the teacher had written a letter to a newspaper criticizing the school board related to a tax increase measure. The United States Supreme Court recognized that that letter related to that tax increase measure was a matter of public concern. But it didn't hold that the teacher's dismissal was. And that's what we're dealing with here. Therefore, because they have not shown that this is private speech on a matter of public concern, she does not have a First Amendment claim to move forward.
I got a backup question. I want to back you up. Page 12 of your brief, you state that you quote claims that are brought in state district court and not in federal court. In those instances, the ex parte Young doctrine does not directly apply. And that's a Schreyer,
yes,
which is an unpublished Corpus Christi case. Do you have any other cases that hold that?
So this court cited to Schreyer not long ago when it related to an ADA and Rehab Act claim being decided. That is at, one moment, if I can find it in my notes. It was a UTA Arlington case.
It was for that proposition.
It was from this court, and it cited to Schreyer saying that, look, we're looking at ADA and Rehab Act claims, so slightly different context, but we're still going to hold that the federal doctrines do not apply.
Okay. And say that again. Tell me the case again. Wait.
Yeah, I'm trying to track down its name right now. It's a UTA case. It's Bullock v. University of North Texas at Arlington. It was
University of Texas at Arlington?
Yes.
Citation, do you know it? Is it? Do you have it? If you don't worry about it. It's okay. We can find it.
I'm not sure I have it offhand. No, it doesn't look like I have it directly offhand. I apologize for that.
We could. We can find it.
The last thing that I'll just briefly touch upon is to the extent that plaintiff's petition makes out a claim for academic freedom. First, as asserted in our brief, we don't believe it's been properly asserted, as in it's not in her petition at all, and therefore it's just not before this court. But additionally, it again goes back to the timeline in this case, right? When was she suspended? She was suspended before anyone delved into anything related to what was said. The student complaint itself, on which we based this paid administrative leave, if you look at that complaint, which is at CR 180 through 182, it doesn't say anything about a viewpoint expressed or a topic discussed in class. There has never been a content-based restriction on Dr. Casper's speech by the university. Again, that goes back to these ultra-virus claims, and what has she alleged against these individuals? She has not alleged she has not factually alleged what any individual named defendant has done to quote-unquote chill her speech. She's made a conclusory statement with no factual allegations to support it, and that is not sufficient, even at this stage, to state a valid ultra-virus claim to overcome these university officials' sovereign immunity. I've got about a minute left. I'm happy to answer any questions that the court may have.
Bill, just a quick one, and it may be too much, and if it is, don't worry about it. But, you know, there's several individuals, and in that kind of laundry list of who they are and what they did, some of them, it's conclusory, and in some ways there's sometimes they don't necessarily even say this person did something. They just said they were present.
Yes.
Did you give any consideration to possibly going down the list and pointing that out to us, or
In the briefing, I attempted to. If you looked at our statement of facts in the appellee's brief, I tried to go through this is what they've said against each person, including just the conclusory allegations. You know, if you're looking specifically at the notice of suspension, it's alleged that Dean Tilton is the one who issued that notice of paid administrative leave. If you're looking at the investigative outcome letters, which again, those investigative outcome letters did not impose any type of restriction or discipline upon the plaintiff, those were issued by Simone Oseko. Beyond that, I would submit that there are no factual allegations against the other individual defendants.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right, thank you, counsel.
All right. Thank you, Justices. I have 5 minutes, and I've got probably 45 minutes worth of stuff to say, so I'll be as quick as possible. So to address the ultra-virus doctrine, on pages 5 through 8 of our reply brief, we went through each individual, as you indicated, providing what allegations were made against them with citation to the record. Any argument in that regard goes to whether there was fair notice or not. We've put them on notice of such claims, which would be a sufficiency of the argument, sufficiency of the pleadings argument, which under the Texas case law would give us the right to amend anyways, and we would ask if that's a finding of the court to send it back to give us an opportunity to amend. There's numerous Texas cases that said that. One of the things that I need to address, because I didn't get into this at all, is the First Amendment argument. And the arguments there were all over the place, because we've got to look at what the standards are. We really have Garcetti at the bottom, Kennedy, the 2022 U.S. Supreme Court case, at the top. And when you look at what we're arguing here, and it was addressed that this you can't talk about the investigation, even on social media. Is the investigation and discussion on social media a governmental speech for Professor Casper, who's an English professor? Absolutely not. So obviously in Garcetti, when he's addressing in a memo that I can do this, we shouldn't do that, relating to his prosecutorial duties, of course that is governmental speech. Whereas in Kennedy, a football coach who had prayer with his team, the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, prayer has nothing to do with coaching football. That is private speech. So one of the things that the Attorney General's Office and TWU has glossed over
is Pickering, which was addressed. Pickering has a balancing function to it, which requires the state to say how the speech interfered with the regular operation of the institution. They didn't do that. They have no evidence on that point. They don't have any evidence, period. They don't even have an assertion on that point. So they missed the Pickering balancing test altogether and their obligation. So when you look at the academic freedom argument, if you look at our pleadings, it addresses things inside of the classroom, and the very function of saying you're demeaning students has to occur in the classroom. So there is an abundance of references to the demeaning of students. That is addressed in the pleading, which when you look at what are the functions of that academic expression, there are two things. There's the grading of a paper on racial epithets, which was the indication of racial discrimination that was addressed. And then there's the value of hard work. Those have both been found to be matters of public concern. Those are addressed at the trial court. That was briefed at both levels. There was a recent case from the Fifth Circuit, which we discussed at great length at the trial court, Merriweather versus Hardtop, where a professor refused to reference a student by gender pronouns that were not their born pronouns. The U.S. Supreme Court says that is academic expression. That is protected under the First Amendment. There's absolutely no doubt that there was an adverse employment action taken against Professor Casper. The findings that they referenced over and over again say she demeans students, and to Justice Birdwell's point, how are we to know what she said? They won't give us the evidence. So one of the key points in this case is the Fifth Circuit's discussion in Buchanan, which if you read the underlying transcript, they try to argue that Professor Casper was talking about her sex life in class. That's not an issue. That's not in the pleading. That's not in the record. That's not any finding letter. Absolutely have to determine what was actually said. They won't do it. They won't tell her because they didn't do really any much of an investigation. As we assert in our pleading, this is an effort to push Dr. Casper out of TWU. It has been an ongoing issue that finally bubbled to the level of why we're here. They're taking action against her for what she said and did, her expression and speech, without giving her.
Tell me, sorry.
Yes, sir.
We're running out of time. In 15 words or less, how was her speech inhibited about what did they tell her not to talk about that was a matter of public concern?
Their finding of demeaning speech, and again, we didn't have the opportunity to counter that with evidence because they didn't provide us evidence, but the demeaning speech and what we're left with is trying to determine what that was, because they won't tell us, comes down to two things: the paper on racial epithets and the value of hard work when teaching individuals that are going to be teaching students English. This was a class to teach people how to teach children. Those matters have been historically found to be a matter of public concern. Judge Manzant has made a finding on the racial issue just in 2022. Judge Jordan in the Eastern District also made a finding on First Amendment with microaggressions in 2022. These are all issues that fall squarely within the First Amendment, and they can't take action against her based on her academic freedom and expression. I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for your time.
Case is submitted. We appreciate you. Excellent arguments, and we are adjourned.